7BR Part Heard.
Hello, and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Rhys Palmer, Chambers Paralegal. We're joined today by 7BR member Nia Frobisher. Nia has a mixed common law practice, regularly representing both claimants and defendants in a wide range of disciplines, including personal injury, clinical negligence, family law, inquests, and commercial work. She has extensive experience working in a range of injury cases, including high-value claims with both personal injury and clinical negligence. Nia has spoken previously on the podcast as part of a Day in the Life mini-series, where she discussed pupillage and the development of her practice. She's back today to provide her insight and discuss the Supreme Court judgment in the case of Khan and Meadows. Nia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So we're here today to talk about the Supreme Court judgment case, that of Khan and Meadows, in which 7BR member Simeon Masquerade QC acted for the respondent. Before we discuss the judgment, could you just give us a brief background to the matter?
Absolutely. So the case involves a woman, Miss Meadows, who had consulted with her general practitioner before becoming pregnant in order to establish whether she was the carrier of a hereditary condition called haemophilia. And she wanted to know whether she was the carrier of that gene and therefore whether there was a chance she could pass that on to any children she had. Unfortunately, she was negligently led to believe by the respondent, her doctor, that she was not the carrier of the gene, when in fact the test she had could only tell her whether she in fact herself had haemophilia, not whether she was the carrier of the gene. That, as an aside, was something that was admitted by the respondent in the case. A number of years later, she then goes on to have a child, become pregnant and have a child who is born with haemophilia. In addition to that condition, he's diagnosed with autism, and amongst standalone difficulties that came with his severe autism, it also made the management of his haemophilia, or makes the management of his haemophilia, much more difficult. In the case, it was said that it had the claimant, Ms. Meadows, known that she was the carrier of this gene, she would have had fetal testing during pregnancy. She would have therefore found out that the baby or the fetus had haemophilia, and she would have terminated the pregnancy on finding out that fact. So those are really the background facts that were an issue in this case.
And obviously we've reached the Supreme Court, but what had the lower courts decided, and how did we progress up to the Supreme Court?
So the key issue that remained was, is the GP liable for the costs associated with just the haemophilia, or is the GP liable for the costs associated with the haemophilia and the autism? In the trial court, the High Court, the judge actually found in favour of Ms. Meadows, awarding her damages for both the costs associated with the child's haemophilia and the autism. And effectively observed that on a but-for basis of causation, the child would not have been born but for the respondent's negligence. She also concluded it would not be fair, just and reasonable to distinguish between the mother who wanted to terminate this pregnancy and the mother who would want to have terminated any pregnancy. And she therefore applied the two Court of Appeal cases of Parkinson and Groom, both of which are sterilisation cases, and therefore found in favour, as I say, of the claimant. However, that was appealed by the GP to the Court of Appeal, and in 2019, the judgment reversed the finding of the High Court, finding that the costs associated with the child's haemophilia were recoverable, but the costs associated with the autism weren't recoverable. It distinguished the cases of Parkinson and Groom. It effectively determined the case based on the principle in SAMCO and found that determinative of the issue that autism fell outside, the costs associated with autism fell outside the duty of care owed. There was no need to consider separately whether the decision was fair, just and reasonable. It wasn't a novel case. It just required the application of established principles. The mother, Ms. Meadows, then appealed to the Supreme Court, as we know, and it was then their turn to analyse the case and the scope of duty principle.
So you've mentioned the case briefly, but a key element of this appeal was the SAMCO case, the South Australian Asset Management Corporation and York Montagu Limited case. What was the key principle applicable in that case to this case?
So the key principle in SAMCO, which was applicable, is actually it's a principle that predates SAMCO, but it was applied and developed in that case by its application, not just to the kinds and categories of damages, but the extent and quantification of damages. And the principle is this, that a defendant is only liable for losses that fall within the scope of duty of care owed. And it's particularly in the context of providing information and advice, you really need to analyse the scope of what that information and advice related to in order to work out not only what damages are potentially recoverable, but the quantification of those damages. Another helpful tool that the SAMCO case developed or created rather was what's called the SAMCO counterfactual. And that's a useful tool in some but not all cases, as this case recognised, where you ask, had the information that the defendant provided been correct, what would the result have been? So it's really just analysing the scope of duty principle, which pre-existed SAMCO, but was really developed in that case. And it was how that, if that was applicable and how that was applicable in the context of a clinical negligence case.
So moving then to the arguments that were put forward, what did the claimant, Ms. Meadows, argue?
Ms. Meadows' line of argument, in summary, was effectively along the lines of the judgment in the trial court, in the High Court, that both costs associated with both conditions were recoverable, that the SAMCO approach was not applicable in the clinical negligence arena, being an approach that's more commonly found in a commercial transaction type of case where there is a very pure economic loss situation. And it's not a principle or an application that is suitable in clinical negligence because of the imbalance of knowledge and power between the parties who are patients and the medical practitioner. Further, the appellant submitted that it was arbitrary and unfair to draw the distinction between a parent who didn't want any pregnancy and the parent who didn't want this pregnancy, as I discussed earlier. And as a matter of pure factual causation, but for the negligence, the child wouldn't have been born. And the fact, which again was a matter agreed, that the autism was foreseeable and therefore the whole of the loss flowed from the negligence. As an alternative, the appellant put forward that even if SAMCO does apply or the principles in SAMCO do apply to the clinical negligence arena for the reasons stated and further as detailed in the judgment, the appellant was not restricted in her claim. The respondent, ably represented, of course, by Simeon Mascarecusi, in summary submitted that the scope of duty principle highlighted in SAMCO did apply to clinical negligence and did apply in this case. And once one analyses the scope of duty principle by way of a series of questions that one ought to consider in a case like this, and in considering what entitlement a claimant has to recovery of damages, the costs associated with the autism fell outside of the scope of duty and therefore weren't recoverable. So that in summary, although probably not anywhere near as ably put as the various QCs involved, is what was argued in this case.
And in reaching their judgment, what did the Supreme Court conclude? I know that Lord Hodge and Lord Sales highlighted the six-step model. Could you explain that and sort of their reasoning behind dismissing the appeal?
Yes, absolutely. So it was a panel of seven justices, so quite a big one in this case. And as you said, the majority judgment was given by Lord Sale and Lord Hodge. Lord Legath and Lord Burrows concurred with the judgment but had a slightly different analysis. But the majority judgment, as you set out, developed this six-step analysis or these six questions which could be applied. And whilst the justices recognise that there's no one correct way to scrutinise a tort of negligence, these six steps or these six questions is a helpful way to analyse the scope of duty principle. So I'll take you through those six questions that are set out in the judgment, at paragraph 28 of the judgment. They were these. So one, which is called the actionability question, is the harm, which is the subject matter of the claim, actionable in negligence? Two, what are the risks of harm to the claimant against which the law imposes on the defendant a duty to take care? That's the scope of duty question, an important one in this case. Three, did the defendant breach his or her duty by his or her act or omission? The breach of duty question. Four, is the loss for which the claimant seeks damages the consequence of the defendant's act or omission? That's the factual causation question. Five, is there a sufficient nexus between the particular element of the harm for which the claimant seeks damages and the subject matter of the defendant's duty of care as analysed at stage two above? That's the duty nexus question, as it was called. And six, is a particular element of the harm for which the claimant seeks damages irrecoverable because it's too remote or because there is a different effective cause in relation to it, or because the claimant has mitigated his or her loss or has failed to avoid a loss which he or she reasonably could have been expected to avoid? And that's the legal responsibility question. So the courts felt that it's possible to consider these questions in varying orders and address more than one of the questions at the same time. In particular, question two and question five can readily and frequently are analysed together. And in a lot of clinical negligence cases, by the time you answer question two, question five is either already answered or obvious. It doesn't take much further analysis. But the court felt setting out the analysis in this way did help to demonstrate that the question of factual causation and foreseeability alone cannot circumvent the question which must be asked in relation to the defendant's scope of duty. It further assists in the determination of the extent of the claimant's entitlement to damages, as we discussed earlier. A further analytical tool that the court considered useful, again, not in all, but in some cases, is, as I mentioned, the SAMCO counterfactual. What would the claimant's loss have been if the information or advice which the defendant gave had been correct? And they found that to be a useful cross-check tool in addition to the six questions. The court found that despite the appellant's, Ms. Meadows' submissions, there was no basis for concluding that clinical negligence was excluded from the ambit of the scope of duty principle, and there was no reason why this principle and this approach should be confined to pure economic loss situations and commercial transactions only. It's a principle that is generally applicable in the law of damages. It highlighted, as I say, that factual causation and foreseeability alone are not determinative, and the parties and the court need to drill down into the scope of duty in most cases, if not all, where that is at all contentious. The question of whether it was fair, just and reasonable didn't come into the analysis because this wasn't a novel or unusual case. It is one where the general principles, when applied, provided the answer to the court. So for those reasons, the appeal was dismissed. And when applying the six questions, in summary, this is what the court found. The first question wasn't contentious. The economic cost of caring for a disabled child are, of their nature, clearly recoverable, clearly actionable. Two, in terms of the scope of duty question, so the important one in this case, this was answered by addressing the purpose for which the appellant obtained the services of the respondent. She approached her GP for the specific purpose of seeking to know whether she was the carrier of the haemophilia gene. And the respondent owed a duty to take reasonable care to give accurate information or advice when advising her whether or not she was the carrier of that gene. As the court said, it was a service concerned with a specific risk of having a child with haemophilia. So it's really important to look at the nature of the information and advice given and what the scope of the service was in order to determine the scope of duty question. In relation to question three, the respondent was in breach of her duty in this case, as was accepted by the respondent. in terms of the fourth question, the factual causation question, the appellant had lost the opportunity to terminate the pregnancy in which the child had both haemophilia and autism, something she would have done if she'd had the fetal testing. And question five, effectively, the scope of duty question meant that question five was quite straightforward, as the court recognised it could be. The law did not impose any duty in relation to unrelated risks which might arise in pregnancy. It followed that the respondent was liable only for the costs associated with the haemophilia. At this stage, the court discussed the cross-check of the counterfactual tool. What would the outcome have been if the GP's advice had been correct? Well, if Miss Meadows had been the carrier of the gene, it was undisputed that the child would have been born in any event with autism. And finally, when it came to question six, there was no question in this case of remoteness or other cause or mitigation of loss, etc. And therefore, the defendant or the respondent at this stage was responsible for the foreseeable consequence of a child being born with haemophilia and the cost associated with that. So in applying the six-stage process, also looking at the counterfactual in this case, the court was of the firm decision and a unanimous decision that the appeal was dismissed. As I said, the judgment was a majority judgment. Lord Burrows and Lord Leggatt gave slightly different analysis in reaching their conclusion. Lord Burrows emphasised the central importance of the purpose of the advice and information and asked whether it was fair, just and reasonable. He didn't feel that the six-stage model was necessary. And Lord Leggatt, again concurring with the judgment of the majority, but put a greater emphasis on the causal connection between the respondent's advice and the applicant's appellant's loss. So a slightly different way of reaching the same conclusion in this case. But it's really that majority judgment and the six-stage question process and that tool, which is what's really important about this judgment, in my view. So that's probably a long-winded answer in summarising. A relatively long judgment for you there, Reece. Yeah.
But no, thank you. You set that out nice and clearly, the six steps and the thought process which the judges went through. Now, this has been a long-anticipated judgment and one that has incurred a lot of discussion online. What does this mean for cases in this area going forward?
Well, obviously, this case is very important for anyone handling wrongful birth cases. Clearly, it's applicable to those. But in my view, and in most people's view, having read the judgment, it's got a broader application in negligence cases, especially in those cases where information and advice is provided upon which a decision is taken or not taken, as the case may be. It's potentially, as some commentators have considered, applicable to consent type cases as well. So that would be an interesting way to see how this case is applied. But whilst obviously it's applicable in the cases where information and advice is given, in my view, the judgment isn't so restrictive as to only apply to those type of cases and could potentially have a broader application. Really, the case just re-emphasises and highlights the importance of analysing the scope of duty of care in every case, really. And it's a good reminder that you can't just rely on but-for causation and foreseeability alone. You really have to drill down in what is the scope of duty. So it's a very interesting case to read and think of how this is going to apply in future and whether we will have judges using this six-step process more often.
Nia, just finally, was there anything else that you thought was of importance or worth highlighting in regards to this case?
Yes, absolutely. As most will probably appreciate, this case and this judgment was handed down on the same day as another judgment in which this same seven panel of justices sat and also dealt with the scope of duty principle. That is the case of Manchester Building Society and Grant Thornton UK LLP. That apply the scope of duty principle and the SAMCO principle in a different and potentially more traditional context of accountant negligence. There's a lot of analysis in that judgment that should also be read, and I would recommend anyone looking at the case of Carne and Meadows to also read that judgment or indeed the helpful summaries that the Supreme Court helpfully provides.
Thank you, Nia. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you, Rhys.
Thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this week's episode, you can find similar episodes from our members where they discuss recent judgments such as Meyer Force Data and CGD, Uber and Aslam, Royal Mencap Society and Tomlinson Blake, and Asda and Brightley. All our podcasts can be found on Chambers' website, Apple Music, Spotify, and SoundCloud. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.